From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The lively League of Left-Turners kicks off the NASCAR season tomorrow, ahead on Only a Game, a Daytona 500 preview, also a reluctant look back at this week's congressional hearings, and a weary look ahead at what they mean for Major League Baseball. And the big Aristotle brings his brains and his bulk to the Valley of the Sun. Also ahead, American junior hockey players aim for Division III colleges rather than the NHL.
I don't think there's a single one of them here that isn't here because they love the game. Our focus with them every day is the day you don't love playing this game is the day you don't play this game.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Wednesday, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform questioned Roger Clemens, who repeated that he'd never used performance-enhancing drugs, and Brian McNamee, who repeated that he had injected such drugs into Mr. Clemens. Charles Sheeler, one of the authors of the Mitchell Report, was also on hand to answer questions. Henry Waxman, the committee's chairman, said he and Representative Tom Davis, the committee's ranking Republican, wished the hearing hadn't had to happen.
Tom Davis and I made this decision reluctantly. We have no interest in making baseball a central part of our committee's agenda. We believed we had a responsibility to investigate a serious claim of inaccuracy.
That report came from an attorney representing Roger Clemens, who claimed the Mitchell Report's contentions that Clemens had used steroids and human growth hormone were false. Representative Davis suggested that the hearings could serve a higher purpose than simply providing Clemens with the opportunity to protest his innocence again.
We're here to again try to disrupt and discredit the crass messages aimed at our children. Today we'll let the American people judge who's to be believed in this unfortunate battle of wills, memories, and reputations. Someone's lying in spectacular fashion about the ultimate question.
Ah, the ultimate question, which would be, did Roger Clemens break the rules and the law, which would suggest that the crass messenger aimed at our children isn't as important as previously suggested. Throughout the hearing, someone continued to lie. This proved frustrating to several of the committee members, which perhaps explains why Elijah Cummings, a Democratic congressman from Maryland, recalled the words of Andy Pettit, a former teammate of Roger Clemens, who acknowledged that he was a recipient of Brian McNamee's injections. Mr. Cummings quoted from Mr. Pettit's affidavit to establish the pitcher's reason for his candor with the committee.
I have to tell you all the truth. And one day, I have to give an account to God and not to nobody else of what I've done in my life.
Neither Mr. Clemens nor Mr. McNamee invoked the deity in testimony, and there were a few dramatic moments during the hearing until Mr. Clemens provoked one when Chairman Waxman tried to summarize the testimony at the end of the day.
But this is what I think we've learned. Chuck Knobloch and Andy Pettit confirmed what Brian McNamee told Senator Mitchell. We learned of conversations that Andy Pettit believed he had with Roger Clemens about HGH. And even though Mr. Clemens said his relationship with Mr. Pettit was so close that they would know and share information with each other, evidently Mr. Pettit didn't believe what Mr. Clemens said in that 2005 conversation.
Doesn't mean he was not mistaken, sir.
Doesn't mean that, but
he does not mean that he was not mistaken,
excuse
sir.
Excuse me, but this is not your time to argue with me.
The argument has continued about whether Wednesday's hearing helped the American people decide to believe Roger Clemens or Brian McNamee, but there's also the argument over what place the U.S. Congress should have in resolving the issue of steroids in baseball. The government's curious relationship to baseball dates back to 1922, when the Supreme Court somehow concluded that traveling baseball teams were not engaged in interstate commerce and therefore were not subject to regulation under the antitrust laws. Professor Julian Zelizer, who teaches history at Princeton University, joins me now to help shed some light on that matter. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me again.
What, if anything, is likely to change as a result of Wednesday's hearing and the various conversations, depositions, and affidavits that preceded it?
Well, ultimately, I think baseball will have to clean up its own house. I think there's limits to what Congress can really do for the private business of a sport. I think what Congress can do through the hearings is just to continue generating concern and to put pressure on the baseball owners to do something. That's what hearings often do. They put political pressure even on private businesses. And I think, you know, having heroes dragged before Congress talking about this kind of steroid use is not good. It's not good for the industry. And so I think that's the function hearings might have.
So does the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform simply disappear from the scene at this point, or do they have some other role to play with baseball or perhaps with some other sport somewhere down the line?
Well, it sounds like they might go into some other sports as well. My guess is once you open up this issue, you can find it in a lot of sports, unfortunately. Football is certainly one of the sports that's been mentioned as another problematic area. So I think it's going to depend what constituents are saying. Look, if people are watching, if they're reading about it, and if they're writing letters to the committee saying, keep looking into this, I think you're going to see more hearings.
Well, you mentioned football, and Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania is presently involving himself in some of the administrative decisions the National Football League has made regarding Bill Belichick's violation of league rules in videotaping his opponents. What is the rationale for that involvement?
That's a little more tricky. I mean, baseball and Congress have more of a relationship, again, because of the exemption laws. Football is a much looser relationship. So I think Specter is really pushing what Congress can do, especially looking into the whole use of the video cameras by Belichick. So I'm not sure. I think he'll get a lot of pushback if he moves too far on this. I'm not sure this is a top thing that Specter wants to be talking about.
It was interesting to me watching Wednesday's hearing. Some of the committee members themselves seem to feel that they shouldn't be holding the hearings at all. What are the chances that the pressure to get out of this kind of thing comes from the Congress people themselves saying, you know, we don't want to be involved in this. There is lots of other stuff we might be doing.
Oh, that's very possible. I mean, right now, especially going into an election year, a lot of members of Congress are trying to use their time wisely, and every hearing they have or every bill they have is meant to resonate on the campaign trail one way or another. And so a lot of members of that committee might put the most pressure on the chairman to say, you know, we can't afford this right now. It's not just whether should we be doing this or should we not be doing this, but can we afford politically to spend our time on this issue other than a few days?
One of the intriguing aspects of Wednesday's hearings was that the attacking and the supporting seemed to be divided along party lines. The Republicans were pretty much for Clemens. The Democrats were more likely to be dubious of what Clemens was saying. Did that surprise you? I mean, the subject was baseball, for goodness sake.
It doesn't surprise me. Partisanship is strong on Capitol Hill these days, and the parties will find ways to fight about anything. The only way in which it makes a little bit of sense is that you have Democrats more likely to be sympathetic to government investigation and to the use of government to take on an issue like this, whereas Republicans take a more leave it alone or, you know, let the guy and the industry deal with this themselves position. But still, you know, it's more about partisanship is everywhere in Washington. So any issue that comes on Capitol Hill, the parties will find a way to divide over them right now.
Dr. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history at Princeton University. He joined me from his office there. Dr. Zelizer, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
The NBA trading deadline is less than 1 week away, but the Western Conference is on its way to becoming even more competitive as the Los Angeles Lakers acquired forward Pau Gasol and the Dallas Mavericks are working on obtaining the services of all-star point guard Jason Kidd. But the move that surprised almost everybody was the speedy Phoenix Suns trade for the big, but not apparently speedy, Aristotle, Shaquille O'Neal. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Steve Goldstein reports.
No one, not even the most ink-stained rumor starters on the NBA beat, saw this one coming. The Phoenix Suns and Shaquille O'Neal seem like the oddest league fit since Michael Jordan decided to try a comeback with the Washington Wizards. Simply put, the Suns are fast, and O'Neal is slow. Phoenix has been known for putting up a shot every 7 seconds or so. O'Neal can barely get past half court in that amount of time. But at his introductory press conference this week, O'Neal said the scribes were underestimating him.
The crazy thing about this society is that if you don't see a person do something, you automatically think they don't do it. So, you know, the last couple of years, I was in a system that we really didn't run. So you guys automatically think I can't run. But, hey, I love to run, especially if I'm playing with a great guy like Steve Nash. And I look forward to making people eat their words. I really do.
In order to acquire O'Neal, the Suns traded all-star forward Sean Marion, the team's best rebounder, and backup guard Marcus Banks. On the surface, it doesn't sound like a lot for a Hall of Fame seven-footer. When the Lakers traded for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in 1975, they gave up twice as many players. But the national pundits were not bashful about questioning the Suns' thought process. Former Suns forward Charles Barkley, now an analyst for the TNT cable network, expressed concern about the 35-year-old O'Neal's ability to keep up with the Suns' speedsters.
He has to play well for Phoenix to get past San Antonio, Utah, and the Lakers. He can't just be there. And let me tell you something. As you get older, it don't work. I mean, that's why they came up with Viagra. At some point, it don't work.
Sports Illustrated's Jack McCallum spent an entire season as a pseudo-member of the Suns' coaching staff in 2005-2006 and wrote a book about the experience, 7 Seconds or Less. His assessment isn't nearly as blunt as Barkley's. He's advising observers to be patient.
I think it's one of these things that's been so dissected. The idea, my God, they're going to win a championship or he's going to sink them into whatever body of water is near Phoenix. I just think it's going to take a while. I don't think it'll be dramatic. I think the ultimate question still comes in May. Are they better than the San Antonio Spurs?
O'Neal took it easy in his first practice session with the Suns. He jogged and participated in some basic drills, taking passes from coaches and finishing with layups and relatively soft dunks. There wasn't much to see, but Phoenix players seemed genuinely thrilled to have O'Neal's enormous frame and championship resume on the court. Guard Steve Nash expressed a simple sentiment.
Everyone's really excited. You know, I think you can feel the energy in here. Everyone's happy to have him around as a teammate, but I think once we got him on the floor, it's a new level of excitement as well.
Forward Grant Hill said it was easier to get up for a morning session, knowing that something new was awaiting the Suns at the arena.
Today was unlike most practices. Most practices, you don't want to be out there, but today everybody wanted to be out there and because you look forward to making it work.
Thanks to an inflamed left hip, O'Neal hasn't performed in a game since January 21st. But that didn't stop him from declaring himself the key element in bringing Phoenix its first NBA Finals victory.
Start selling the T-shirts now. All the marketing people, I'm giving you this one for free. The sun will rise in Phoenix. Start selling them now. $9.99.
But Phoenix hasn't played in the NBA Finals since 1993, when the Charles Barkley-led Suns fell victim to Michael Jordan's first championship three-peat. Despite the loss, more than 500,000 Suns fans lined the streets of downtown Phoenix to honor the home team with a parade. Arizona Republic columnist Bob Young says there won't be a similar celebration this season.
They've been close. I think the only thing that gets the parade now is the championship.
O'Neal is going to work with Phoenix coaches and trainers over this weekend's NBA All-Star break. He's scheduled to make his on-court debut on Wednesday against a team he's more than slightly familiar with, the Los Angeles Lakers. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Some soccer soreheads claim that the career of David Beckham was already in decline when he left Real Madrid and signed with the Los Angeles Galaxy. Maybe so. Beckham was injured for most of last year's MLS season, but he demonstrated on a recent morning at Hollywood's Club Central that in at least one respect, he hasn't lost his magic. A little after 1 a.m., Beckham was approached by a young female fan. The Galaxy star obligingly planted a kiss on the woman's cheek, and she fainted dead away. Hardly a stranger to such circumstances and ever chivalrous, Beckham said, "Get her some water, she'll be okay." I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Hockey Dreams in Ohio. But first, even the most casual sports fan is probably aware that Dale Earnhardt Jr. will not race for his late father's team this year. Those with a more thorough knowledge of the sport might know that F1 superstar and Mr. Ashley Judd, Dario Franchitti, has joined the ranks of NASCAR drivers. Me, my knowledge pretty much begins and ends with the fact that the Daytona 500 will roar across lots of TV sets on Sunday. Luckily, I can turn left to Matt Crossman, who covers motorsports for the Sporting News. Matt, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I got that right? Turn left?
Yeah, you did. I was actually pretty good. I'm not often accused of turning left, but for NASCAR, I will.
Good. Excellent. I was happy to read that even you were confused by Daytona's qualifying system. Did you ever figure out who, in fact, qualified on Thursday and why?
I figured out who did simply because I looked at the starting grid. But it's exciting for the fans. It involves racing and I think math and maybe physics and maybe your high school English test scores.
Wow.
But every other week of the year, it's basically here, line up, whoever drives the fastest laps, that's where you'll start in order. They don't do that for this weekend. I like it, and frankly, I don't need to understand that. I just need to enjoy it.
Of course, the qualifying races don't just determine who gets in, but they also set the starting order. Hendrick Motorsports driver Jimmy Johnson will be on the pole with teammate Dale Earnhardt Jr. in the second row. Joe Gibbs, racing driver Denny Hamlin, joins Earnhardt Jr. in the second row, backed by teammate Tony Stewart in the third. In all six of the first 10 starting spots are filled by Hendrick's or Gibbs drivers. Should all the other teams just kind of shrug and go home?
You know, it wouldn't hurt them if they did. They're still going to make, you know, probably $250,000 even if they finish dead last. But yeah, it certainly is shaping up to be, there's seven cars on those two teams, and it's shaping up really to be a battle between those seven. And I think most people are expecting / hoping for a Dale Jr. win because that would be the most sensational headline.
Well, Dale Jr. won the first qualifier, and he seems to be settling into his new team very comfortably. But the switch might not be easy for his fans. While the stands at Daytona normally were a sea of red, I understand that fans are a little more confused about what color they're supposed to wear this year.
That is a great question, because it used to be red without a doubt, and now he's got red, white, and blue for the National Guard. He's got green for AMP, which is like a power drink. Those are his two new sponsors, so it's no longer red. And I'm kind of curious that it'll be the same Daytona 500, you know, sunny weather, cars spinning around, but when you look into the stands, they won't be red. They'll be, I don't know what. So it'll be an interesting to see how that sort of persona of the sport shakes itself out.
Gibbs switched to Toyota this year, and Denny Hamlin's win in the second qualifying race on Thursday gave Toyota its first win in NASCAR's top circuit. More interestingly, it was the first win for a foreign manufacturer since 1954. Can Toyota hope for further success this year?
Oh, yeah. If Toyota doesn't win a points race, I would say the season was a complete and total unmitigated disaster. It's that simple.
As far as last year goes, Toyota can hardly do worse.
Total unmitigated disasters. They were terrible last year, but there's a pretty rational explanations for it. The first is that there's an old cliche in NASCAR that your teams are only as good as your people. But it became a cliche because it's true. And if you look at their drivers last year, they didn't have the best drivers, and they didn't have the best crew chiefs, and they didn't have the best engineers. But this year, with Tony Stewart, Kyle Busch, and Denny Hamlin, they've got three of the top six or eight probably drivers in the whole sport, and with Greg Zipidelli as the crew chief, they've got one of the top five crew chiefs, and plus Joe Gibbs is one of the top two or three owners in the sport. So it's the people that are going to make all the difference in the world.
Of course, last year they also didn't have the right stuff in their gas tanks.
Yeah, also they're not cheating this year. That should help them.
Another interesting change is NASCAR's promise to let the boys be boys and go easier on punishing drivers this year. That idea seemed to be tested when Tony Stewart and Kurt Busch ended up in the officials' trailer last week after a skirmish on the track. The story goes that Stewart punched Busch in full view of the officials, and both were put on probation for 6 weeks. We're not sure what that means, or at least that's what's alleged to have happened.
The story goes that Busch mouthed off to him, you know, called him a name or something, which would be, frankly, totally in character, and that Tony took a swing at him, which wouldn't be outrageously outside of character, allegedly. But my take on it is, frankly, I don't buy it, because I don't believe that you could punch another driver in full view of of, you know, the biggest NASCAR officials there are, and there'd be absolutely no repercussions. However, if all the fans think that that happened and there were no repercussions, that sure makes it seem like NASCAR is going easier on their drivers.
What does probation mean in this context? They were going to both be in the race.
That's a good question. I think it means we're really not all that mad, but to make it look like we did something, we're going to put you on probation. And then he'll, you know, if he does something next week, then he goes on double secret probation. If he does something the week after that, it's triple secret probation. Yeah. And then after 6 weeks, well, then all the probations are over, so he's cool.
Okay. I was surprised to learn, Matt, that NASCAR ratings are down, and there are even some empty seats at the races. The Associated Press tells me that is because so many of the old guard have retired. This year, Dale Jarrett and possibly Sterling Marlin will retire, two more old guard guys gone. Can the new guys capture the attention of fans?
Yeah, I don't buy that as the reason. Because the sport exploded when the new guys came in, it doesn't hold water for me that the old guys leaving would be the cause of the decline. First, it's a lot more cyclical. TV ratings go up and down. They were down considerably, so it's not something that's just poo-poo. But one team absolutely dominated last year, and unlike other sports where, you know, when the Patriots did that, everybody got excited about it to watch it. For some reason, it annoys NASCAR fans when one driver or team wins everything. So I think that has a little bit to do with it. And I don't really see the loss of Sterling Marlin and Dale Jarrett. I mean, they're two great stars, and I don't mean to insult them, but I don't think their departures would move the ratings needle at all.
All right, we've put this off long enough, Matt. You're on the record as saying that this will finally be Tony Stewart's year to win the Daytona 500, but we'll give you a last chance to revise that prediction as the engines begin to warm up.
No, I'm sticking with Tony. He is not only is he the best driver in the field not to have won the Daytona 500, he might be the best driver ever not to have won the Daytona 500. And I know him fairly well, and I know he is as determined a person as I've ever met, and you know that's what gets him in trouble is when that determination is not met with success. He gets angry and frustrated. But I think he's learned over the years how to win at this track. He's won here numerous times, and I think this is going to be the one that he finally pulls into victory lane.
Matt Grossman writes about motorsports for the Sporting News. Matt, thanks again.
Thanks for having me on.
For generations, Canada's vaunted junior hockey leagues have sent the Bobby Orrs, Wayne Gretzkys, and Sidney Crosbys to the NHL. The story is different for the younger and less visible junior leagues in this country. Ron Schachter recently visited the Junior Lumberjacks, Cleveland's entry in the Central States Hockey League, and he has this report.
On a late winter's night at the Iceland USA rink in Strongsville, Ohio, the Cleveland Junior Lumberjacks, most of them a year or two removed from high schools across the Midwest, go through their skating, shooting, and defensive drills. They're among the thousands of young players on more than 100 practically unknown junior hockey teams around the country.
5-6 minutes hard work and footwork. Let's go.
The U.S. Junior Leagues got their start in the 1970s, inspired by Americans reaching the NHL and winning Olympic gold. But Lumberjacks coach Bob Jacobson says they've gone through a growth spurt over the past decade, as the supply of graduating high school players has outstripped the demand from the limited number of college teams.
There are so few college hockey spots available in comparison to other sports. The number of players that are playing in high school and or, say, youth midget hockey, for them to go to college hockey, they're all forced into this funnel. So what happens is you've got to upgrade your game from the level you were playing at.
That's what second-year goalie Alan Schneider had in mind when he tried out for the team.
I played for a high school that really wasn't that good. It wasn't one of the top high schools around here. So I figured I might as well play a year junior to try and get some looks from a college or two.
Schneider has improved his stock and helped his team to a 25-11 record this season against the likes of the Peoria Mustangs, Grand Rapids Owls, and Dubuque Thunderbirds. Good for third place in the 13-team Central States Hockey League. The CSHL is one of a half dozen lower-level Tier 3 teams in the juniors. While some of their players move up to the higher echelon North American and United States hockey leagues, and eventually to Division I colleges, most are aiming toward Division III hockey programs, where they won't receive athletic scholarships. Jacobson notes that their 2 or 3 year stints in the juniors give them a chance to keep playing competitive hockey, hone their skills, and even grow an inch or two.
I don't think there's a single one of them here that isn't here because they love the game. Our focus with them every day is the day you don't love playing this game is the day you don't play this game.
In fact, CSHL players love hockey so much, they pay for the privilege here. $4,000 covers the cost of ice time and travel for their 45-game season, peppered with 10-hour road trips over wintry highways. And center Ben Polacco adds that they toil in obscurity. Though the Lumberjacks' average home attendance is up to 121 from 39 last year.
Just not a lot of people know about it because, like, around here, for example, like, football is really big, and especially, like, our high school football. So especially in, like, this community, no one really knows about it, except for families, obviously, and a few of our friends.
Okay, sit down and eat.
It's dinner time at Marla Evans' house in the Cleveland suburb of South Euclid. This former hockey mom, whose son once played for the Lumberjacks, is now a house mom to 3 defensemen from Chicago, Peoria, and Manhattan, Kansas. Many players in the junior leagues leave home, find a host family, and get day jobs, since practices take place at night and games mostly on weekends.
They don't come here to party. They don't come here to get into mischief. They come here to play hockey.
No. Give her a piece of cauliflower.
Evans says that this regular dinner hour has become one of the few dependable events in the home life of her junior hockey players.
Sometimes it changes quickly because they get traded. It's the real world here when, you know, they're here and then they're gone. We've already had 2 leave being traded from this house. So they come and go, sometimes pretty fast.
Still, Matthew Perry, who was dealt to the Lumberjacks from his hometown Peoria Mustangs, appreciates the comforts he's been able to find along the way.
Just having the experience to grow up, mature as a person, as a hockey player, all in one. The experience of living away from home, meeting people, it's friendships you're going to have for a lifetime.
Perry and his teammates are also receiving a hefty dose of college counseling. Since November, Lumberjacks coach Bob Jacobson has been helping them locate and apply to colleges with the right combination of academic and hockey programs. Those schools are responding, and with some remarkable results. Nichols, a Division III college in central Massachusetts, had endured 26 straight losing seasons before stocking almost half its roster with junior hockey alumni 3 years ago. They've been winning ever since, including a 16-5 record this year. 23-year-old Nichols Jr., Glenn Caccaro, played for the CSHL Cincinnati Cobras. He says that he arrived with more than enhanced hockey skills.
I'm so happy I took 2 years off after high school. You know, I got all the nonsense out of my system, and then when I actually got to college, I actually focused on school, work, and what I was doing. I kept my goals in mind and stuff like that, whereas if I think I came to college right after high school, I don't know where I'd be.
Nichols athletic director Charlene Roberts sees an even larger impact.
I think it's made a great difference, both in our classroom as well as on our ice, and also socially for our students. These young men come in, they've had some different life experiences that they can share with those college undergrads, and our traditional undergrads don't have that maturity yet. And so they're able to learn some of these life experiences where they wouldn't have that opportunity if they were just surrounded by 18, 19, 20-year-olds.
Bob Jacobson admits that even though he'd like to keep his team together next year, he's putting his players' college prospects first.
We're trying to be proactive. Not saying I don't want them back, but if they're ready, I want to push them out the door.
College plans for this year's Lumberjacks class will have to wait at least another month as they gear up for the Central States Hockey League playoffs in the third week of March. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Strongsville, Ohio.
You're listening to Only a Game. What does the NHL, the League of the Lockout, the Glowing Puck, shrinking attendance, and much general ridicule need to do to reestablish itself as one of North America's most popular pro sports? A lot, according to many, but former NHL pro Dave Silk thinks the league's resurgence should begin with one simple step, the reestablishment of the nickname.
In today's NHL, Eastern Bloc transplants abound, along with Swedes, Finns, Germans, and the like. It's a numbers thing. With up to 20% of the NHL coming from somewhere across the pond, there are so many Vladis, Alexes, and Igors on the ice that there just isn't room for as many nicknames as there once was. I say bring back bruisers like Eddie Boxcar Hospodar, Chris Knuckles Nylund, or Frank Seldom Beaten, whose nickname changed to Often as his career ticked away. There were goalies like Gary Suitcase Smith, Lorne Gump Worsley, Glenn Chico Resch, and Jim Seaweed Petty, who was so enamored with his nickname that he nicknamed his wife She-Weed, and their baby boy, Wee-Weed. The Philadelphia Flyers, also known as the Broad Street Bullies, were a veritable cornucopia of monikers. Led by legendary Freddie the Fog Shero, there was Dave Sledgehammer Schultz, Battleship Bob Kelly, and Don Big Bird Selesky, and their teammate Bill Barber, whose striking resemblance to a Sesame Street character earned him the nickname Ernie. There were nicknames for the forward line units, the production line, the diaper line, the triple crown line, the kraut line, try that one today, and the French Connection. But my favorites were from the late, not-so-great Hartford Whalers. Blaine Stoughton, Mike Rogers, and Pat Boutette, a.k.a. Stash, Dash, and Crash, were followed by the rough-and-tumble line of Nick Fatiu, Don Knockbauer, and Ray Neufeld, forever known as Nicky, Nacky, and Newfie, though admittedly they might have been neutralized by the likes of the Rhyme Line, Barry Beck, Leroy Heck, and Buzzard Fleck. So please, spare me the gory details. Salary caps and free agency, Stanley Cup champs in California, Carolina, and Florida. I don't care about all that. What I'm looking for is a good old-fashioned nickname fix. And that, fellow hockey fans, would indeed make it once again, as the late, great Badger Bob Johnson liked to say, a great day for hockey.
Dave Silky Silk is a former NHL player. He was a member of the gold medal-winning 1980 U.S. ice hockey team as well. He's currently a principal at Cadence Capital Management in Boston. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Anyone who's ever unpacked a bag of groceries to find broken eggs, bruised apples, or cookies reduced to crumbs will appreciate the talents of Erica Jensen. As it turns out, the National Grocers Association also recognized those talents. Ms. Jensen won the distinction of Best Bagger at the association's recent competition in Las Vegas. Erica Jensen, who works at a grocery store in West Jordan, Utah, was judged on speed, weight distribution, dress, and appearance. She took home $2,000 in prize money and also received a trophy, which will sit beside the trophy her older sister Emily won in the same competition 3 years ago. Congressional hearings into the possibility of fraud, conspiracy, and steroid use within the family begin this week. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Hello, baseball, my old friend. It's time to listen to you again. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Some people commenting on Wednesday's congressional hearing starring Roger Clemens and his former trainer Brian McNamee have concluded that Clemens did himself some good on that occasion. Others have supposed that he may soon be facing perjury charges. What do you think?
What possible good did he do himself?
Well, I suppose they think that because he wanted the opportunity to state his innocence in a public forum, he's now had that opportunity. I agree with you.
He did it incredibly badly. He made Curly Howard sound like Demosthenes. That was the worst performance by a witness as regarding demolishing your own case since Alexander Butterfield.
Do you think it was significant that several of the members of the committee before which Clemens and McNamee appeared felt that the most convincing witness whom they heard was Andy Pettit?
Yeah, because he wasn't there. I thought it was more interesting, and I still don't quite understand why, except for the principle of screwing with Henry Waxman, why this thing split so decisively along partisan grounds. The war on drugs has been a bipartisan catastrophe for 30 years, but all of a sudden the Republicans have decided to defend the ballplayer and excoriate his drug impresario, and the Democrats did the opposite. And it was absolutely split down party lines, and it's unfathomable to me unless they're just trying to make Waxman's life miserable.
Well, there were stories that before the hearing, Clemens visited numbers of congressmen. You don't suppose he only went to the offices of the Republicans, do you?
Well, I don't know, but I can assure you that Roger's personal charm is not enough.
Roger Clemens may or may not be pitching for somebody this summer. Andy Pettit will be pitching for the Yankees. Given that the players were nearly unanimous in their determination to avoid talking about steroids to George Mitchell or anybody else, how comfortable do you suppose Andy Pettit will be in that clubhouse?
I think he'll be fine, and I think he'll get a standing ovation whenever he comes out to pitch at Yankee Stadium. I think he's now been sort of reckoned to be a whistleblower. It sounds a little silly to me, but I think that's what's going to happen.
While this costly and time-consuming vortex was whirling in Washington, D.C., Senator Arlen Specter met with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, and they discussed Spygate. Specter's conclusion was that more investigation is needed. How much more? Will it ever end?
Well, I don't know, but I think there may well be more investigation needed by the National Football League. I don't know if Arlen Specter's day job should get involved here. Goodell looks worse and worse on this one by the day, by the way, because destroying the tapes was not only a bad evidentiary move, it was a very bad political move.
Meanwhile, if he is to be believed, New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick has misunderstood the National Football League's rules against taping opposing teams for more than 7 years. How come he couldn't get them right?
I don't understand why this man is allowed to count his own money. Anybody who believes that particular story, please stand on your head.
LSU, the seventh-ranked women's basketball team in the nation, knocked off number one Tennessee on Thursday night. Tigers head coach Van Chancellor said after the game that he didn't want to answer his cell phone after his team fell behind by 19 points early in that game because he was afraid it would be LSU's athletic director and that he'd be fired. Maybe he should ask for a raise now, make the call himself.
Did anyone ask who it actually was? Who does he know that didn't know he would be playing Tennessee that night?
Well, I thought most coaches probably did turn off their cell phones before the game actually began, but
well,
I guess
I can understand
wrong.
How you want to keep on top of your recruiting, but this is really silly. Who would not know where he was? I mean, honey, I told you never to call me when I'm working.
According to an NCAA report released this week, Indiana head basketball coach Kelvin Sampson and his staff violated telephone recruiting restrictions and lied about it to investigators. Is there something in the water there in Indiana, and is it the same thing that was in the water in Oklahoma?
I think it's bottled water, and I think it's in the Sampson household. Now, there's a coach that should have his cell phone taken away. There's no question about that. Indiana knew what they were getting with this guy. He wasn't going to change. He won't change wherever in the lower Division I he winds up after this season. It takes a lot to make people around the country yearn for the days of Bob Knight, who at least didn't do this kind of foolishness.
On the pro basketball front, in the middle of the week, it looked as if Jason Kidd might escape from the New Jersey Nets. What happened to keep him tangled up with those Nets?
Well, Devin George, who was supposed to go to New Jersey, exercised a provision in his contract that allowed him to block the deal for the moment. I think Mr. George will probably find a little something from the agent general manager fairy under his pillow in the next week or so, and this trade will go through.
During a game on Sunday, Florida Panthers forward Richard Zednik nearly had his carotid artery completely severed by a skate blade. He's expected to be released from a Buffalo hospital on Saturday, but he will miss the rest of the season. There's been talk of neck protectors in the National Hockey League, similar to the ones used by junior and amateur players. You think the NHL will require them henceforth?
Well, I'm fairly sure that the old guard will fight them because they fight any improvement in protective technology. As we've often said, that if you follow their arguments to the logical conclusion, hockey is best played naked.
Charlie, it's a big weekend for your alter ego, Mr. NASCAR, the Daytona 500.
As we always point out, the Super Bowl comes in the first race of the year.
That's right.
Dale Jr., a make-or-break season for him. He's already won one of the preps. He's not going to win this weekend, though.
Well, he looked pretty good in the qualifying. He finished first in one of those races.
He did. He looked really good in one of the preps, but he's not going to win this weekend. And I'm not going to tell you who is.
Well, maybe we should quit right now then. What's the point of going on?
Kurt Busch is going to win.
Okay, very good, because I had promised our listeners a dead certain lock on this one.
Kurt Busch is a dead certain lock.
A gentleman in Great Britain who acknowledges that he's a gambling addict is suing the bookmaker who accepted his bets, claiming said bookmaker shouldn't have accepted those bets. I'm asking strictly for entertainment purposes, of course, but do you like the chances of Mr. Graham Calvert of Wearside on this case?
I guarantee you that no matter how you feel about this issue, this gentleman will bet the wrong side of his own case.
Here's one we missed from last week. A week ago Tuesday, Thomas Dold of Germany ascended the Empire State Building's 86 flights of stairs faster than anybody had ever done that before. And so I guess the only question is, was Fay Wray at the top?
Well, I was going to point out that this gentleman now only holds the inside record for climbing the Empire State Building. The outside record will always be held by Mr. Kong of Skull Island.
The original King Kong, exactly. And finally, perhaps to the dismay of the owners of the other 169 breeds and varieties of dog represented in the Westminster Kennel Club, a humble beagle took best in show, or perhaps given his name, this particular beagle wasn't all that humble.
Who's numero uno, baby? I had nothing but beagles growing up. They were all named Bo. That's the way we rolled in my house. If I had been triplets, they'd all been Charlie. First beagle in the history of Westminster. I would, in his behalf, if I could do that. Which I apparently can't.
Charlie Pierce, El Perro Numero Uno, as far as I'm concerned, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time. Thank you very much, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
A year ago last June, Tom Porcello and his son set out on what has become a popular rite of spring, or summer, or even fall. Together, they attended Major League Baseball games in Cleveland, Baltimore, Chicago, and Arlington, Texas, among other venues. One thing Tom Porcello discovered along the way was that each ballpark had its own distinctive sounds, and that's what he's here to talk about today. Tom Porcello, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
This trip to various ballparks began as a father-son bonding opportunity, as I understand it, and I assume that it worked on that level.
Very well on that level, yes.
At what point did it start evolving into something else, and what was that something else?
Almost from the beginning, a little bit, in the sense that I had assumed that we would put together some iPhoto slideshow, something like that, at the end of the trip of all the pictures we were taking of the ballparks. And I had this idea that rather than finding the right song to play with them, I would want to be able to mix in, wouldn't it be great to have the actual sounds from the various ballparks that we've been at as what we're listening to as we look at the slides. So I had taken along a stereo microphone and a mini disc recorder and was recording in very random ways. And as I was listening to them a little bit, as we would be driving from one place to the next, I began to realize, you know, the sonic experience of being at these various stadiums was really quite different from one place to the next. And I began to think about maybe a little bit more systematically recording so that I could try to pick up on what those differences, in fact, actually
were. Do some comparisons and some contrasting. The father-son connection is a great one. I have no problem with fathers and sons going to baseball games, obviously. But you were bringing a level of expertise to this that most fathers don't. You were looking at this from a professional perspective as well, right from the outset.
Yes, my training is in both linguistic anthropology and ethnomusicology, and these are both fields that spend a great deal of time thinking about the way that auditory and acoustic phenomena, whether it's language or whether it's music, relate to social and cultural life.
Several of the teams you visited had theme songs that were woven right into the introduction of the starting lineups. Shall we listen to the way the Cleveland Indians did it?
For your Cleveland Indians.
Without the ball game in front of me, I feel as if I'm listening to the soundtrack of a baseball movie. Do you suppose that that's the effect the people in Cleveland had in mind?
I think it might be. I mean, what they're trying to do, I think, at the stadium is to create an experience that the entire crowd begins to share. And it's experience about the Cleveland Indians, the reason for being in the ballpark, the way that the Indians are part of the community of Cleveland. And I think that that soundtrack, the Foo Fighters, it's times like these, we learn to live again. The time is in the ballpark, and the we is the crowd at Jacobs Field.
We're living again.
That's right.
Through the Cleveland
exactly.
Indians. At one of Major League Baseball's two oldest parks, you found the traditional organ was still in use, or at least the organ music. I don't know if it was coming from a traditional organ. Should we allow ourselves to be transported to Wrigley Field for a few moments? Maybe it's because I attended my first Major League game in 1956, but I like that approach. What about you?
I do, too. One of the things that really struck me at Wrigley Field, and I think the same thing, of course, happens at Fenway Park, is that the announcer gets into a dialogue with the organ player around the way that they sort of intone the voices of the players, and then the organist provides a little musical flourish, and the crowd joins in. So it becomes a very participatory, almost a performance on the part of the organist and the announcer and even the crowd that's there.
But we have come to a time when it's an experience that we're likely to associate with minor league hockey games rather than Major League Baseball games these days, isn't it?
I think it is. And in fact, one of the things that I hope to pay a little bit more attention to in the future as I go out and see more baseball games are differences between minor league baseball stadiums and Major League Baseball stadiums in how they handle this.
You know enough about baseball and which teams are good and which teams are not so good so that you probably weren't surprised by what you saw on the field too often. Were you surprised by what you heard in the ballparks often?
I was surprised by a very simple thing, which is how different the ballparks sounded from each other. And I suspect the reason that I was surprised by that is that as you listen to broadcasts of baseball games, whether it's on radio or whether it's on television, very seldom do those parks sound different from each other because of the way that they're mixed for broadcasts.
All right, I'm going to let you tell us about what you encountered when you went to a game in Arlington, Texas, where I guess one anthem was deemed one anthem too few. Did you know you were going to hear the, I guess that's the Texas state anthem when you went to the ballpark?
I had no idea, although in retrospect, perhaps I should have expected it. What with it being the state of Texas, but also we saw a number of interleague games during the course of the trip because of the timing when we took it. And mm-hmm. This was the Rangers and the Astros, and perhaps they don't do this at every Rangers game.
You did hear the national anthem in Texas as well, of course, and perhaps we can listen to a little bit of that, and then let's let our listeners guess what they're hearing as that anthem ends. Now, that wasn't a championship game or anything because the Rangers haven't been in any championships recently. Were you surprised at the various patriotic symbols, some of them ear-splitting flyovers like that one at the ballpark at Arlington?
Well, I was surprised, and again, perhaps in retrospect, I think maybe one needs to remember the Rangers were at one point owned by the current president of the United States. I think that baseball has a particular relationship to American patriotism and American identity that makes us see those patriotic symbols in a lot of ballparks, or at least makes a lot of ballparks very conscious about representing a certain idea of Americanness. And it's an Americanness that has to do with values that we supposedly all share, values that are deeply rooted in our past. And I think that visually we do see a lot of those symbols. One of the things that I've found very interesting in traveling from stadium to stadium is that they look much more similar to each other than they sound similar to each other.
Hmm.
And I think you hear those sonic differences in two very obvious places, one of which is the music that is chosen to be played between innings very often speaks to the musical taste that you associate with that particular part of the country.
You've received a number of grants to visit more ballparks in this upcoming season and continue your studies. Do you hope to soon be able to draw some anthropological conclusions regarding the way sounds are changing in ballparks?
I do. One of the things that I'm very interested in is the way that the composition of Major League Baseball has been changing in recent years. Major League Baseball was, for a long time, very much a white American sport and an African American sport. In recent years, it, of course, has become much more a Latino sport. And because baseball has this particular relationship to American nostalgia and American identity, and because this change is happening at a moment where there is a lot of nervousness in the United States about immigration, I find this to be a very interesting tension between what's happening in baseball and what's happening in larger discourses about the United States and its immigrant policies right now.
So this is an academic pursuit. I have great admiration for you. I taught for many years and never figured out how to get funded to go to baseball games. I think it's pretty good.
Well, thank you.
Tom Porcello is an associate professor of anthropology at Vassar College. He's currently fooling the head of his department into thinking that going to baseball games constitutes anthropological research and fooling a lot of people who fund grants as well. I guess good on him, say I. Tom, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Bill. Don't let them in on my secret.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino and Bill Estes at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view photo galleries or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Representative John Duncan, Republican of Tennessee, who insisted during Wednesday's congressional hearings that the proceedings were useful and necessary.
I have heard some holier-than-thou types on television say that Congress has much more important things to deal with.
Well, Congressman, this profaner-than-thou radio type would never suggest that. In fact, I'd like to congratulate you and your colleagues for a resolution last December recognizing Christmas as an important Christian holiday. That would be House Resolution 847. Nicely done. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.